Welcome. I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy who has a continuing interest in effective pharmacy leadership. Our purpose in this conversation with a successful leader is to hear in their own words aspects of their career so we can glean tips for current and future practitioners, because leadership is quite different than being a pharmacist. By way of a brief introduction of my guest today, Sharon Enright, she has had one of the most unique pharmacist careers I can think of, all of her positions in leadership. She completed a hospital pharmacy residency, the ASHP executive residency, was an ASHP division director, state chapter executive, has started several businesses, sold one, and worked for an accounting firm. And now she is again reinventing her career as she shares her observations on leadership with us. You exemplify a dual career couple, you and Steve, before that term was even popular, I think. You have two children that are out of college. Talk a little bit about the challenges of balancing two careers and a family.
Well, first, let me say that I've been very fortunate to have a husband who's been very supportive of all of my crazy ideas of where I wanted to go and move with my career. In terms of balancing career options, I think it's important to realize that it does have to be a balance. There are times in your life when you have to make a move or a change for one individual. That comes around, and you know, the other person has to have their opportunity for growth and expansion later on. We've certainly moved for my career, we've moved for Steve's career. It didn't always seem to be the most opportune time, but I think as long as you keep concentrating on the fact that there are always options and opportunities and keep alert to them, you can both continue to grow, and it's got to be supportive.
How did you handle childcare when the kids were young and you were both working?
Well, you know, after 11 years at ASHP, my husband was offered an opportunity to move to Boston to a corporate headquarters of the company that he was working for, and we really didn't want to leave DC, and so we thought of the most outrageous list of things that we could ask so that he wouldn't be asked to move to Boston. And they said yes, and so then we needed to move, and that was really the opportunity for me to begin my own business. I was encouraged by a number of folks in the pharmaceutical industry and in financial analyst firms who were watching the kinds of things that I was writing. It gave me the opportunity to work at home, to have someone in the house with my child and ultimately two children, while I had my office there, and to keep very close tabs on them on a minute-to-minute basis if necessary, but to continue the work that I was doing. So I feel in many ways that I had the best of all worlds because I could continue to work in areas that were intriguing and exciting to me, but also maintain a very close relationship with my children.
Tell us what value you saw and what the ASHP executive residency was all about.
Wow, it is such a unique opportunity. You know, as I said, you cram into a year's time, a lifetime of experience and contacts and networking that is almost beyond description. You know, I think that the first week that I was in that residency, I was assigned to attend a residency preceptors conference and sat down and had dinner the first evening I was there with Warren McConnell and Cliff Lachelet and Paul Parker and Don Brody and Don Franke, and you know, it was intimidating, but it was just oh so exciting, and they were generous in including me in their conversations and in seeking my opinions, and it was probably the most powerful experience in terms of setting me on a course for a career that you could expect to have ever.
How did you find out about, or how did you get into the executive residency?
Great preceptor in my hospital pharmacy residency, the second week I was there, he said, I know what you're going to do next year. And at the time, the executive residency was in hiatus. They had not taken an executive resident for several years. And so Don Besty set out to make sure that it would be, you know, reinstated and that I would have an option to apply for that. And I was fortunate to be selected, and it was just a wonderful experience, wonderful program.
As you think back over your career, what are some lessons that you wish you had learned earlier rather than later?
Ask questions, consult, look for other people's opinions and gather them in to kind of accumulate all the best thinking. And I guess to really abandon the thought that you could have the right answer or any answer at all, that life is so complex and situations are so challenging in most instances today in healthcare and certainly in hospital pharmacy, that we really have to abandon the idea that we have answers and really need to work collaboratively to try to find solutions that work in a particular situation. But the freedom from that thinking you've got to have the answer, I think, is very liberating.
You've undoubtedly encountered some tough situations or some obstacles. How do you handle that yourself? Because you've overcome them and become very successful.
You know, I think one of the things that I've learned over time is that if you don't have a clear direction or a clear sense of how you should be moving forward in a situation, it's typically because you don't have enough information. And so if you can begin to gather more information and to better assess the situation, typically the answer comes to you, the solution, the move forward step. And most of the time, again, in this complex environment, it's a matter of finding the next best step in the right direction, not necessarily having a clear course to the end point. So I think that's how I've moved forward in many instances.
Tell us a little bit about your responsibilities when you worked for ASHP.
Well, after I completed the executive residency, my initial responsibility at ASHP was the as the director of the Division of Membership Services. Again, this is, you know, a position that had not existed before. In fact, I've never had a job that has been filled by anyone else. There are always new positions that needed to be developed and expanded and defined. When I assumed that position after the executive residency, ASHP had a membership of about 6,800 members. It was at a point in time when the society had really become totally independent from APHA and was actively recruiting members, and hospital pharmacy was growing very quickly. And in the period of time that I filled that position, the membership grew to about 22,000. So it was a huge opportunity to see growth, to see the excitement of people who, you know, envisioned a new type of career in pharmacy and saw the excitement of clinical pharmacy practice. And for me, a wonderful opportunity to get to know very personally a lot of those new members. They had a letter from me in their mailbox every week, whether they wanted it or not. And I traveled very extensively with the affiliated state chapters. So got to know a lot of people personally. It was a great opportunity.
So talk a little bit about the staff culture at ASHP. How many staff were there, and what was the culture like, and then what is culture?
I believe I was the 23rd staff person at ASHP when I joined, and now, of course, it's a much, much larger organization. It was a very tight family, very small, tight culture. We all interacted very interpersonally. You know, there was a lot of sharing. There wasn't the sense of layering in the organization that evolved later on as it became a much larger business venture. We were also in the middle of going through a building renovation, and so we shared experiences like leaking ceilings and falling ceiling tiles and having, you know, air hammers in the room next door as you were trying to do conference calls. So all of that brought us together as a very close group. Culture is just so important in organizations, and as I operate in my consulting role now, I see that that is so often a critical factor in the success or failure of policies and practices and procedures in health systems. It's a vital factor that really defines the behaviors of an organization. What are the accepted norms? You know, how do people come together or not come together within a community of people?
So where does culture start, or where does it come from?
Well, you know, the popular notion is that you can change culture, and really culture changes as a function of knowledge. And so I think leaders can be influential in setting a vision and setting standards and setting goals for an organization, building behavioral expectations, but you really have to move that very slowly and very carefully, because it really depends on each individual's perception of how they fit into that larger group.
After membership services, you had another position at ASHP.
You know, I guess at about the point in time that I was finishing my master's program and had decided to focus on strategic forecasting and systems and behavioral sciences as a major focus, ASHP's leadership through its House of Delegates was really focusing on reimbursement-related issues. They were also demanding a much more comprehensive view of where the organization, where the profession, and where this segment of the profession was going, and how we were going to achieve that. So strategic planning became a major focus. And so in his typical visionary way, Joe Otis said, I have a new job for you. We're going to create a new division for planning, management, and reimbursement. And as you are finishing this master's program, it seems to me that your interests might align with these needs. And so I assumed that position with the expectation that we would really balance attention to reimbursement issues, management, and strategic planning for the organization. Well, within 6 weeks, the prospective payment legislation roared through Congress. The rules of the reimbursement game changed dramatically, cataclysmically, really. And so at that point, it became important for someone to figure out, one, what this change was, what were the critical factors in a very complex set of parameters, and then to begin to educate our membership and others about what was going to define a winner and a loser in the new environment. And so that really became my major focus of attention, and I spent probably the vast majority of my time for the balance of my tenure at ASHP working on the whole concept of DRGs, what that meant for our practice, how we had to change and adapt to be able to operate efficiently and effectively in that new environment. And it was wonderfully exciting because it was an area that nobody knew anything about and everybody wanted to know about it. So
how did you get yourself up to speed on all this new information?
I went to hearings, I went to, you know, educational programs, I read everything, I read, you know, the legislation that was being proposed. It was a point in time where after the prospective payment legislation passed, it was a very much a regulatory focused environment. As the regulators were determining how they were going to enact the legislation, it was an iterative, every day there were nuances of change that would define how this would play out. And because it was difficult to always capture that real time in writing, it was just so critical to interface one-on-one with people who were influential in that process. And so really tried to soak up as much information as I could from every possible source, and then to interpret that back down, to simplify it down to something that would be understandable and actionable for the ASHP members who are going to have to deal with it on a very real-time basis.
Did it feel like a risk to you to give up the membership services that you were comfortable in and move into something that was very, very different?
Well, yeah, risk in the sense that, you know, I really was moving into an area that I didn't have a lot of discrete knowledge of, but nobody did, you know, and so that's what better time to jump into something than when everybody is trying to learn simultaneously. I'm a fast learner and I read a lot, so that didn't worry me so much. What I think was challenging was that there were no guidelines. You know, there were no bumpers, no curbs, no governors on where this should go or you know, the direction that it could take for our members. And so that was the good news and the bad news. You got to define pretty much for yourself what the scope of services could be and should be. Nobody else knew about it, so it was hard to rein it in at times, you know, and it grew very dramatically as a focus of attention for the organization. And ultimately, we were providing as a service analysis of practice that became very valuable to pharmaceutical manufacturers, to financial analysts, to lots of peripheral groups who were looking at healthcare and trying to figure out where to put their investment dollars.
Did you ever have any fear that you might not be successful? Or does that just not cross your mind?
My father always told me I was very lucky. And so when you go into a venture with the sense that you have luck and good fortune on your side and you work hard, I don't think, you know, failure is really at the top of your mind.
So why leave ASHP after, I think, roughly 10 years?
Well, at that point, I had an eight-month-old daughter. My husband was being transferred to Boston, and it seemed to be an opportunity that we couldn't pass up. It was disappointing to leave Washington and to leave ASHP, and certainly to leave the excitement of that reimbursement arena that I had worked so hard to be on top of. It was a point in time when there really wasn't much happening at a state level. Most of the action, unlike today, was at the federal level at that point. And so there wasn't a natural transition for me to move to. And really at that point, a number of folks from the pharmaceutical industry and from financial analysis firms suggested that they would be interested in continuing to receive the kinds of insights that I could provide, and that starting my own firm might be a good opportunity that, if I did that, business would likely follow. And so it was an opportunity to move to a new location, to Boston, to really find a different model for my family, for childcare, and to be close to my daughter, and to move in a totally different direction. It was, I guess, a risk.
So tell us how that evolved.
Well, initially I began working with a number of firms around data analysis and data mining. My thinking has always been edgy, and so when there were edgy ideas and edgy firms and new, breakthroughs in some particular area, technology or whatever, my name usually would pop up at one point or another. And so I had lots of opportunities to talk with firms that were looking at new ways to enter the healthcare marketplace. It was also a point in time when a lot of companies realized that pharmacy was pivotally important to decision making in healthcare organizations, and so they were looking for ways to interact more effectively with pharmacists, and having the network of contacts that I did was enormously beneficial. So I worked with, companies that collected and sorted data for hospitals to give them an aggregate look at their drug utilization in a more efficient way. I worked with a number of companies that were introducing automation technology, both mechanical automation and systems automation, but always looking at ways to improve the quality of care, to clarify and to give a different view of how operations worked and to make them more efficient.
So you incorporated a business?
I did. Okay.
What did you learn about all of incorporating a business?
That it's a lot easier than you think in many ways. Over the years, I found myself, as people retired and were interested in starting their own businesses, I found myself being the kind of go-to person for the, five steps to take when you want to do this, and have talked with literally dozens and dozens of pharmacists over the years who have taken that path for one reason or another. I guess what I learned more than anything is that you have to stay alert to your environment. You have to be consciously aware of change, where the change is coming, where the new edge is, and how that is going to affect patients first, and how it's going to affect practice second, and then think about how to make it more palatable a change, how to make it an easier transition. And that's really the crux of what I've done over the years.
And does it, what kind of finances do you need to have to start a business?
I think I probably started with $2,500, you know, for some equipment, a fax machine. That was quite revolutionary at that time in 1983 to have a fax machine, a FedEx account, a word processor at the time. My husband was working for Wang Laboratories, so I had a natural connection to getting that technology. You can complicate it extensively, but fundamentally you have to have the commitment to it, and you need some very basic requirements, and then it's about keeping moving.
What about the role of a vision, and what was your sort of vision in some of these companies?
You know, I think at the core, my vision has always been that we needed a lot of change, that there were, and that I'm not an incremental thinker, that the time that I spent at ASHP was oh so valuable because it's such a methodical, rigorous, incremental change process that incorporates so many people's thinking and their visions. But I was a little more impatient than most. And so I could see this as a way to kind of dangle some change out in front of people so that they could see a target that they could move toward that they might not think of otherwise. And so being in Boston and kind of the hotbed of the Harvard, MIT healthcare thinking of we've got to have a revolution, we've got to make this system change because it's not working the way it is, even as far back as 1984, really spurred my thinking. I was there when the Institute for Healthcare Improvement was forming, and Don Berwick was a frequent speaker at the School of Public Health on all of the opportunities for quality improvement and performance improvement. It was the beginnings of when the Joint Commission was starting to say, we can do better and we're going to build a process to do that. It was not popular wisdom at the time, certainly, but for me, it was a hope that this would give a path to true improvement. And so I think that regardless of the various approaches I've taken to it, that's really been at the heart of what I've done. My kids used to ask me when they were little what I did really did, because they knew I was a pharmacist, but they really didn't understand how what I did related to the pharmacist that they would see in the pharmacy. They laugh because I would always tell them that I was about change, and that really is very seminal to what I've tried to accomplish with my career, changing things for the better.
Talk a little bit about the continuing education programs that you've developed. That's what I tend to be most familiar with that you've done.
Well, I had the good fortune, I guess in the late 1980s, to connect with a group of people who were interested in supporting quality initiatives in healthcare and to establish on behalf of their company a different basis of relationship with their clients. They wanted to not only interact with their pharmacist colleagues, but they wanted to get to know nurses and quality managers and administrators and CFOs. And genuinely had a belief that their very large pharmaceutical company had an obligation to invest in quality of care. And as a result of that, they charged me with developing a library of resources that would provide skills-based educational programming for a vast array of professionals. And so to that point, my emphasis had been very pharmacy-centric. At that point, it really became much more collaborative, much more interactive within a wide range of professions. And so eventually, we had developed a series of probably 35 or 40 educational programs, had a faculty of 250 people who provided these programs across the country for audiences that included boards of trustees of hospitals and academic medical centers, physicians, nurses, quality managers, case managers, risk managers, pharmacists, a wide, wide array of people. And so for me, it really further stretched my thinking outside the boundaries of pharmacy, identifying sources of information and improvements that were real that our practitioners just had no knowledge of. And so it was just a wonderful opportunity to integrate some of that thinking and pull some of those ideas back and to watch light bulbs go off, you know, and people say, wow, I could do that. That would work in my organization. Sometimes coming into these programs kicking and screaming, didn't want to be there, you know, but you could see by the end of that experience that they had a new way of thinking, a new set of options.
Explain what you provided these speakers with.
Well, I guess my initial responsibility was to identify the topics and the framework for the programs that would be meaningful and applied, and then to obviously research those topics and to provide a very skills-based, comprehensive, curricular approach to the topic. So whether we were talking about drug use evaluation or patient satisfaction or, you know, building a resourceful patient, it was about creating operational, actionable information that all of these different practitioners could use to change the focus for their patients. Was very patient-focused. And we provided slides, very comprehensive scripting for the program, not certainly that we were asking these speakers to read the scripts, but provide very comprehensive background information that would prepare them to address these topics in a very interactive way. Lots of small group discussions, very, very interactive, you know, sort of what ACPE is looking for today in educational programming, to much more involve the participant in the active learning process.
So as a speaker, what would the speaker end up doing then?
Well, you know, we provided training for the speakers. We provided lots of background resources, all of the sourcing articles and texts in many instances. What many of my speakers told me was that they did this not so much for the speaking opportunity, but to have access to the information, because it kept them at the forefront of thinking in areas that they might not discover for a long time otherwise. And so my job was to kind of go out and find these ideas that had potential, that were being used successfully somewhere, and then to, again, integrate them back into a practice that might not have experienced them yet.
So what kind of feedback from participants have you gotten over the years to this?
Well, sometimes surprising. You know, we did a program in Salt Lake at one point, and a lady came to the registration area and said that she had driven 8 hours from northern Idaho to come to this program because she had been to several other NRITE group programs before and that she didn't want to miss this one. Recently, I was coordinating a program for the American College of Healthcare Executives at their Congress meeting, and an administrator in the audience came to me and said, "Are you the NRITE of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania? Because I remember going to some of your programs about a dozen years ago." So it's always surprising to me when people have that kind of recollection or recall, and that it's so positive that it would encourage them to attend another sort of programming event that you're involved with, but it's been rewarding.
So how did you make contact with people outside of pharmacy that have become speakers for you?
Well, some of it was serendipitous. You know, I've just had good fortune in being connected with people. One of the infectious disease physicians that I've worked with very closely over 15 or 20 years now just happened to be part of a program that I attended, and we connected, and he started to interact with the programming that I was developing. In other instances, if there was a new topic area that, and I'll choose guidelines implementation, which for many years was a challenge for, and still continues to be a challenge for many organizations. There was so much work being done at Harvard and at the Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Organization, I picked up the phone after seeing some articles in Health Affairs and dialed this author, and he answered the phone, and he was responsible for the guideline implementation initiative for the Harvard hospitals, and we began a collegial relationship of, you know, exchange of information. I guess what I've found over the years is that the people who are edgy in healthcare change are so wanting to share their information. They're so accessible, and it's merely a matter of having the courage and the interest to make that contact. And there's so much need for change that when a change agent meets another one, there are just sparks. You know, it's a natural.
I know you've gone to various non-pharmacy meetings, like meetings on systems thinking. Talk a little bit about that approach to broadening really what you did.
You know, I guess that that time in Boston was just so valuable to stretching my thinking and to exposing me to so many ideas. It was a point in time when, you know, it was a springboard from my master's program, but the whole systems concept was really expanding. The notion of chaos theory was really growing, and people were seeing real-time application. And I was there in an environment where I could be aware of these small groups of people, the Society of Learning, the Systems Thinking in Action Group, Pegasus Systems. Were you not there, it would be hard to scratch out that stuff, but I was there, and it was a great opportunity. And it, in each of these instances, there were subgroups that were actively looking at how to apply those principles to healthcare. And I was just fortunate to be in the right place at the right time and to meet some of those people and to have the good fortune to share so much of their very rich, innovative thinking. And, you know, I think of myself as kind of an integrator. So Lily Tomlin had a character in her one-woman show that was the Cosmic Bag Lady. And she would, like, catch stamps in the air and ideas, and she would slap them on herself and say, well, that's interesting, you know. Maybe I'll use that someday. I'm not sure where that fits, but it'll fit somewhere. And I kind of thought of myself as pharmacy's Cosmic Bag Lady sometimes. You know, I've got all these ideas. They fit sometimes, and sometimes I'm still waiting for where they fit, but it's about integrating them into a fabric that will be meaningful for people who are so busy every day with the things that have to be done that day that they don't have time to think at the edge.
Talk about the use of Knowledge Cafe and how we might use that within the pharmacy world.
Sure. Again, and you know, having attended so many of these systems thinking and action programs, and these are programs of 3,000 to 5,000 people from worldwide across many, many industries. I think the first one that I attended that had a Knowledge Cafe, I was sitting at a group of people at a table with a group of people who represented a woman who was the chief quality officer for the Postal Service in Great Britain, the woman who was the head of security for the airport in Jakarta, a gentleman who was the head of finance for a major financial investment firm, and then I think Meg Wheatley was the last person at our table. So it was a kind of heady group of people to be with. What was interesting was that the focus was on change management, and this notion of a knowledge cafe presupposes that any group of people has the answers for any problem that they have to solve, that there isn't enough dialogue or conversation to really explore how to extract that information and to make it useful. And so this is a set of structured exercises and questions that gets people into a situation of conversation or dialogue so that they quickly, very quickly, get to the heart of critical issues, and then within this larger group, share that information. And I would say that within a period of 60 to 90 minutes, this group of 4,000 people sitting in little groups of five at a time, you know, would address a few questions, and then four of the people at the table would get up and move to other tables. And so there was this migration of ideas throughout the group that was palpable. It was so exciting. And these were not people who were kind of neophytes to learning approaches or to, they certainly were not naive relative to change. And yet the excitement that they felt in being able to tap into the power of a group of people who have knowledge but don't have the capacity or the opportunity to share it at that kind of a level of detail was just amazing. And so I think there's wonderful opportunity to apply it to a number of issues. I think there are leadership issues it could be applied to. I think there are patient safety issues that could it could apply to. And I, you know, you and I have talked many times about how to use that concept and how to work it into any number of venues that are available to us.
So what's the key about the questions that are asked in a Knowledge Cafe approach?
Big questions, big probing questions that that don't have answers, that force people to think about their own environment and how they could act, behave differently so that the results that they achieve are different than the ones that they're living with today.
So what would you need to do this? You need small tables?
Bistro tables, you know, paper, stacks of paper on top, lots of markers and crayons, and one person at a table serves as sort of the recorder for the group. People are encouraged to scribble and doodle, and a few questions are introduced. There's a dialogue or a conversation at these tables. Then this iterative migration occurs where those ideas are seated around the room, and periodically you bring the group back to a larger discussion and you pluck out those ideas that are bubbling up to the surface.
So talk about mind mapping.
Mind mapping is a concept that's, it's a recording tool, it's a planning tool, it's a thinking tool. It's frequently used in conjunction with the Knowledge Cafe. And essentially what it does is to provide a visual display of a conversation with all of the most critical features, and more importantly, the connections, the relationships between ideas. And ideally, at the end of a session, whether it's a Knowledge Cafe or a meeting or whatever, each participant would walk away with a visual map, a visual image of the key concepts and ideas of that conversation as thought-provoking stimulus for them to carry those ideas forward. It's a really unique experience. It's very powerful. And I know you've kind of played with mind mapping as a tool for your own consulting work, and it's something that is hasn't been mainstreamed, but it's becoming more mainstream. I'm seeing it as a reference tool of choice in many of the training and development journals that I review regularly. So it's becoming something much more common.
I found the mind mapping very helpful, because on one piece of paper I can put down my thoughts, show the interrelationships, and then review them. So it is very, very powerful. You've had several of these businesses in your career, one of which you eventually sold. Talk a little bit about somebody being willing to buy you and what all of that comes about.
Well, that was pretty amazing. Shocking, as a matter of fact. In a period of 3 months, I was approached by all of the major pharmaceutical wholesalers with interest in acquiring my business. And it was a point in time when the wholesalers were very much thinking that they needed to have an active consulting group. And being acquisitive as they are, rather than build one, they were more prone to buy one. You know, it was an interesting experience and one that I enjoyed and learned from enormously for a period of a year, but it was clear to me that that I was not cut out for that corporate environment, because so many of the things that I valued most about my work, the ability to be nimble, the ability to do things that were outside the mainstream, without having to convince, you know, an army of people of the wisdom of those ideas, that was more important to me than I had realized. And so after a year, I took a sabbatical for a year and traveled and did my art and painting and silver work and enameling and pottery and basketry and threw myself wholeheartedly into a whole nother set of activities.
Talk about what a non-compete clause is, in case somebody has to sign that. What does that mean?
Well, essentially a non-compete restricts you from competing directly head-to-head within an industry or within a client group with a particular group. And typically, if your company is acquired, you are subject to a non-compete for a period of time. And in my instance, it was a much more stringent one, in that I really was restricted from almost all activity for that just 1 year period, which wasn't all that long. But it required me to just move in a totally different direction.
But once that was fulfilled, you started another company.
I did. And I went back to some of the same things that I did before, some of the educational programming, some of the activities around technology introduction, and then moved into some other newer activities as well. Again, it's keeping your eye on the horizon, looking at the environment and seeing what the needs are that are not being met and figuring out how to do that.
You then moved into an accounting firm. Talk a little bit about that. That was another corporate sort of position. What was attractive about that? What did you do with that?
Well, I guess in some ways it was reminiscent of taking that position as the Director of Planning Management and Reimbursement, because it was another pivotal time in the reimbursement around healthcare, and particularly around pharmaceuticals, with the introduction of Medicare Part D. And the opportunity that was presented to me was to build a practice around pharmacy managed care and Medicare Part D services that did not exist. It didn't exist in any of the big four accounting firms. And to build that within the Ernst & Young environment, and to provide very robust services around what is probably the most seminal change in healthcare financing in the last 50 years. Medicare Part D, the impact for that program stretches far beyond the use of pharmaceuticals, and its impact has been enormous on healthcare and healthcare organizations, health plans, and it's been really exciting to be in the middle of that and see how that's evolving.
And again, that was a set of knowledge that you had to get up to speed on, correct?
Again, it was at a point in time when nobody really knew it. You know, it was brand new. We were all struggling together. And it's enormously complex. I think I have a fairly solid understanding from a policy perspective and from a legislative and regulatory perspective, growing appreciation for the compliance issues. But I was fortunate to partner with some people who have a very, very deep and rich understanding of the operational implications and nuances of this legislation. And it's a challenge to most of the organizations who are dealing with it. It's regardless of size, reputation, this has been a very challenging program and continues to be for most organizations.
You've had such a varied career. What kind of career planning advice do you like to give young people today?
Well, Paul Parker always he met with me every year at the mid-year and at the annual meeting to ask me what I was doing and to encourage me to continue it, because it was a clear demonstration for others that there were rogue paths that could be taken. What he always told me was to always have a 5-year plan. I'm not sure that 5 years is a good target any longer. The world changes too quickly. But I guess the advice that I have most clung to is advice that Joe Otis gave me when I was a resident, and that was to think big and always have a plan B. And if you do that and you stay attuned to what's going on in your environment and take advantage of the flow of opportunities as they float past, and work hard, I think there are enormous potentials for us to expand the influence of pharmacy in the healthcare system.
So how does a young person today make contact with people?
It's much harder now than it used to be. when I was a resident and as I began to attend ASHP meetings, we still had institutes, you know, and there were so many opportunities throughout the year for connection with a very diverse, geographically diverse, and professionally diverse group of people. You know, that doesn't exist now. There's been so much compression in the, you know, management ranks and organizations, that demands in practice are so different. The structure of meetings is so different. It's much more challenging now. I'm not sure that I know that there's a clear answer to your question, but I will acknowledge that it's much more challenging and much more difficult. If I had, I guess, one piece of advice, it would be, again, to not be passive. You know, if there's somebody, you know, who has ideas or has written something that you find challenging, you think there's a connection for your practice, reach out to them. You know, people are more than willing to share and anxious to, I think, build their connection, their network of connections within the profession. And I think that you'd be pleasantly surprised by that more proactive approach.
Certainly the local and state professional organizations is a place to begin some contacts. How do you network? How would you do that today?
You know, I think you begin to network within your own organization. It's relationships that build on relationships. The whole concept, you know, in one of the educational programs that, you know, became sort of a bedrock of the programs that we did over the years was around teaming and collaboration. And one of the principles there that that frequently comes to my mind is that groups are based on pairs. Pairs of people work well together or not so well together, but it's that pairing relationship that creates collaboration effectiveness within a group. And so you really need to just continue to meet individuals, and that iterative pairing builds a very complex network of contacts, because the people you pair with have connections, they connect you with those people, and there's a rich emergence of expertise and diverse perspectives that really, I think, help you to stay edgy, stay fine-tuned in your focus, to be thinking about new concepts, and to not be so set in a single view of a single solution for the way things operate in your practice environment. It's that stepping outside yourself, stepping outside your practice, and seeing and hearing what other people are thinking that allows you to go back and be more effective.
I think one of the things that I try to encourage people to do is have business cards with them, and making that relationship, exchange business cards, because then you've got that contact information. And if the other person doesn't have one, which frequently they don't, I give them mine and ask them to email me, because right. Again, we then can do this networking, which is so powerful about how our careers evolve.
Well, you know, from that perspective, networking is so much easier today because of the electronic interfaces, the social networking that exists that certainly didn't exist 10 years ago, even certainly not 20 years ago. It's a matter of you persistently pursuing that and recognizing it as important. It's not something you can be passive about. It's making an investment in putting yourself out there to other people, and in the process gaining an awful lot in return.
Yeah, if you think about your career, how that's benefited you is pretty phenomenal, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Tell us what the Pharmacy Leadership Academy is about. You're the course master for that program.
Quite a title. The Pharmacy Leadership Academy is a distance learning program that creates an opportunity for emerging leaders to focus on critical core modules that are essential to their development as leaders. And each of those modules consists of some self-learning, self-development, self-assessment. On the front end, there's a presentation, a one-hour presentation that focuses on key concepts that are extracted from both that advanced learning as well as the experience of the faculty, and then an interactive component teleconference that's case-based and is really intended to pull together all the key concepts and have the participant apply those. And you know, we have an introductory module that looks at the pharmacy enterprise within the larger organization. We have an emphasis on people. We have an emphasis on finance, on automation and technology. The module that I work on is leading for results. And so what we've tried to do is give a very comprehensive overview in a one-year period of time for these young leaders who may not have an opportunity to participate in an academically based program. They may not have the resources within their organization for staff development. And so it creates yet another opportunity for them to learn, one, but also to interact with leaders who have been successful within the profession and to have the opportunity to interact with them to share that experience.
Now, with a distance learning, do they need to travel to do the program?
No, they can do this program at their own pace. And really the only portion of it that is time specific is that interactive case-based session at the end of each module. So, you know, we feel that it's a program that gives enormous flexibility to the participant and yet gives them a very rich exposure to both topics and people.
Would pharmacists that aren't current leaders find useful information?
Oh, I think so. And again, you know, that small L leader concept is that everyone needs to be a leader within their practice environment. The focus of that leadership may differ, but the skills and behavioral traits that are needed are pretty universal.